So when I first met Samantha Washer, my guest on tonight's KX935's The Sharon Hour, I have to admit, I felt a great affinity with her. Not because she's beautiful and has fabulous hair, which I envy, but because we both managed to pursue quite interesting careers without having much ambition to start with or a particular passion. We've done very similar things throughout our professional lives, each winging it. I fell into TV and film production. Samantha fell out of it. I was in sales, selling milk and glass bottles with my husband when we started our own dairy business. She too was in sales with her husband, who had his own business. And with a few detours in between, we've both ended up interviewing people. I for KX935, for The Sharon Hour. Samantha, who you might know from her byline, for Stu News. And even though today I'm the one that's interviewing Samantha, I'm actually rediscovering things about myself by reflection. And though I may say we've both made a career out of winging things, you've got to show up and you've got to be prepared and prepared to jump too when opportunity comes knocking. What's that quote? Something about opportunity not wasting time for those who aren't prepared. Samantha Washer was prepared, just not for her change of heart.
I double majored in film and English literature / creative writing, so I did a lot of writing, but never had any intention of being a journalist.
It's sort of like me, just because I didn't want to be there when people were going through traumas and stuff like that.
Yeah, and that's what I ended up doing after film school. Sort of, you know, you take the job you can get, and it was with a company at the time doing movies of the week, and the trend at that time was true stories. And so, you know, there would be this sort of sensational story and I'd have to be the person calling those people and trying to get them to sign their stories over to us. And I just never quite felt good about that.
That's exactly how, I mean, I find it fascinating, people's true stories. Obviously, that's what I go after. It's what you go after. But the idea also of traipsing in when they're in the middle of trauma.
Yes.
Is too much, and plus I don't want my life to be full of other people's tragedies either.
Yeah, and that's why I like the Stu News thing, because it's probably very similar to what you do. It's you get people, they're amenable to the process and you're not really interested in the dark side of their
life. Exactly. Well, I don't mind the dark side of their life so long as they volunteer.
Right,
them
right.
I mean, that's actually more interesting, but I also, you know, it's not my job to just invade people's
right.
lives and make them feel uncomfortable. I don't like that.
Yeah.
I also started out as a producer, or I was a producer for most of my life.
Oh, wow.
But in advertising, so I didn't have to go after traumas. We just we went on boondoggles, we went around the world and stayed at the best hotels. This was the heyday of advertising.
Sounds much more glamorous than what I did.
Do you feel that what you're doing now just suits you to the bone, the interviewing and journalistic stuff, or is there something else that you would rather be doing?
Well, that's my probably biggest downfall in life, is that I kind of take sort of whatever presents itself. I'm not a particularly driven person. You know, I'm not somebody who wakes up and like, oh, today I must, you know, I have to do this. I wish that I was like that. I'm not. And so the way I've found Stu, I found that I really enjoy it because it allows me to meet people that I normally wouldn't meet. It's not like my burning passion in life necessarily, but I do really enjoy it. And so I'm not sure I've found that burning passion.
I know what you mean. So, but it gets you out of the house.
Yeah. So,
and if you're not proactive, it's sort of,
you know. I mean, my friend and I did start a business that we're getting going with each other, which is kind of fun, but she approached me. So I'm, for whatever reason, I just sort of go along and people tend to like say, hey, do you want to do this? I go, okay.
You see, then you don't need to be proactive. It's nice to be hauled into things.
It is, but it would be nice to have more focus and direction, but for whatever reason, I sort of had it when I went to film school. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, but I knew that I wanted to be in that industry. And then going into that industry and realizing, oh, wait, no, I really don't like this. I don't like this industry. Ever since then, which was a long time ago, I've sort of been like, all right, okay, I'll try that. So I've tried a lot of different things and they all have pluses and minuses. And, you know, I'm just one of those people that, I mean, I've done things that I never thought I would do.
But
Like be in sales. That was just not what I would have ever, I thought I would have started before I would have been in sales.
What were you selling?
I was selling promotional products. Yeah, so we weren't married at the time, but he ended up being my husband, had a business, a very well-established business that sold promotional products to the movie studios. And so I went to work for him. You know, I was commissioned, 100% commissioned sell promotional products to, doesn't have to be movie studios, that's where his niche was, anyone, you know, desperate time, right? You just sort of start calling people on the phone and somehow, I don't know, desperate times for desperate measures.
Yeah. Do you hate it? Or were you good at it? It's kind of nice if you make the sale. You weren't cold calling, right?
Or... Sometimes I was, yeah. I was sort of desperate. I didn't hate it. It was different because I had never been very financially driven before. But in sales, that's kind of the point. You know, I mean, the product is not, it's something that lasts for a couple of days. I mean, for the release of this movie, and then it's gone and forgotten. So
Rubber figures and stuff.
Yeah, like t-shirts, hats, whatever. I mean, we did all kinds of different things, but, you know, they give stuff away when they open up when a movie releases. And companies, they give out the pens with their
and
names.
The grab bags,
stuff. Yes, all that kind of stuff. So nothing, it's not, even though you might come up with a great idea, it's not something that's going to rest on someone's case for the rest of their life. So it just sort of came about from the paycheck, which, like I said, I've not ever been particularly interested in that, but I'm kind of competitive. So I was like, all right, if this is the job, might as well try to do that and do the best you can. I got a new computer and a bright future in sales, bright future in sales,
Heading for the airport on a misty morning, gonna catch a flight to Baltimore. Try to kill an hour with the whiskey sour, if there's time I might have just one more. I gotta do some quick reading for the big meeting, but my head is spinning and I can't quite open my eyes. As long as I don't have to drive, I'm gonna get my lips together. Cause I can't live like this forever. You know I've come too far and I don't want to fail. I got a new computer and a bright future in sales, I had a line on a brand new account, but now I can't seem to find where I wrote that number down. I try to focus, I'm staring at the screen, pretending like I know what all these little flashing lights mean. Gotta get my lips together, cause I can't live like this forever. You know I've come too far and I don't wanna fail. I got a new computer and a bright future in sales, a bright future in sales, a bright future in sales, a bright future in sales,
You're listening to The Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James, and my topic tonight is Winging It, something both I and my guest on tonight's show, local writer Samantha Washer, have done. And don't knock it, it can be a valuable pursuit.
Just, I've done a little bit of, I worked for the government.
What were you doing for the government?
I worked for the County of Orange. I was hired as an intern, and then like a month later, the county went into bankruptcy.
Really?
In 1994, 95, somewhere around there. It was the largest municipal bankruptcy in history at that point. I think probably no longer the case, but they kept me on, which I cannot figure out why. But it was an interesting, in that regard, it was kind of interesting to be working for the government when they're bankrupt.
What was your job?
I was hired as an intern, like I said, and then they wanted to market the beaches and parks. And so they were looking to put businesses, like their names, on trash cans or benches, you know, kind of monetize that to help offset the expense. So that's what I was doing when they hired me. And then they went bankrupt. And then somehow, I don't know how, but they moved me into being an analyst, and I got really good at Excel. which now I can't even, I can barely do anything with Excel. But at the time, I remember laughing, going, how did I get here and why am I doing this?
What were you analyzing?
You know, I don't even
you can't remember.
It was kind of one of those where I knew I wasn't going to do it for very long. And from then, that's when I went to boyfriend at the time was like, I'm going to save you from this. Like, this is just too terrible.
Was he already successful in his business? Yeah. So why did you feel panicked about building up more business or selling more?
Well, just because I was on a commission. I was still supporting myself.
Oh, he wasn't yet your husband?
No.
I see.
And also, I was sensitive to the fact that everyone knew we were seeing each other. And so I didn't want to come in and be like, oh,
I got the girlfriend job.
Yeah, so she's going to just sit here. And I mean, I was kind of conscious. I needed to show that I was here to work. He's kind of a tough in that regard. So he was like, sink or swim.
How long were you guys married?
We were married for 22 years.
Same as me, 23. Do you want to say anything more about that?
We're very good friends. Just came back from our daughter's spring break together. We go on, you know, people are kind of shocked at how well we get on. And I'm very grateful. I mean, I can't say how grateful I am for that, because I certainly know a lot of people who have not and are not having that experience.
And you just didn't live well together, or... I don't want to get too personal if you don't want to, but it's just interesting to people always why people...
I think, you know, a lot of marriages, you just realize you've sort of gone apart.
Outgrown each other.
Without really noticing it.
I think that sort of happened with me, other than he ran off with a 19-year-old, but...
Well, that happens too.
Okay. It's funny what happens. I was actually older than him though when we married, so I think I just got old comparatively, but still 19 when he was about 50 was a bit much.
That's a midlife crisis.
Yeah, totally.
Right front. Marriage is a long road.
It was a teenage wedding and the old folks wished him well. You could see that Pierre did truly love the mademoiselle. And now the young monsieur and madame have rung the chapel bell. C'est la vie, said the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell. They furnished off an apartment with a two-room Robux sale. The coolerator was crammed with TV dinners and ginger ale. But when Pierre found work, the little money coming worked out well. C'est la vie, said the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell. They had a hi-fi phone, oh boy, did they let it blast. 700 little records, all rock, rhythm, and jazz. But when the sun went down, the rapid tempo of the music fell. C'est la vie, say the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell. They bought a souped up jitney, was a cherry red 53, and drove it down to Orleans to celebrate the anniversary. It was there where Pierre was wedded to the lovely mademoiselle. C'est la vie, say the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell. Truly love the mademoiselle. And now the young monsieur and madame have rung the chapel bell. C'est la vie, say the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell.
You're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. Shooting the breeze tonight with local Lagoonan and writer Samantha Washer. We've both had to wing it a little in our professional and private lives. Both of us the products of divorce.
And actually, I don't know about you, but I'm sort of glad that I had a whole other chapter of my life. I would never have chosen it because I'm a Cancer. I stick around. But I actually rather love... Well, you have children, so you still have people demanding your time and attention. See, I don't. And I love being able to make my own schedule and do my own thing.
I can't imagine that. I mean, I sort of like being accountable, but you have moments where you're like, oh, I wonder if it would be just to get on a plane and go somewhere.
Yes, I know. The thing is, I don't get on planes. I mean, I have my dog, right? So that's half the reason. So I guess I am accountable
right,
to my dog.
Yes, you are.
There's always something. There's always someone requiring your attention.
We should do that to ourselves.
I know. No, it's true. Actually, and I'm such a homebody anyway. I'm much more comfortable being at home, not a huge traveller. I mean, it would be nice just to be able to be plonked somewhere and spend right. a few days there. But
yeah, the act of travelling these days is not that enjoyable.
Tell me about the judges in your background. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, so both my grandfathers were judges. My dad's dad was a Superior Court judge in Santa Ana, and then my mom's dad was more well known, and he was on the state court of appeals for many, many years. I think he was the youngest city judge appointed. He's like 30 when he became a judge in the city of Newport Beach.
What is a state court of appeals, actually?
That is where somebody doesn't like
appeals
the,
a judgment.
Yeah, they don't like their judgment, and it gets appealed, and then he would write the opinion. I mean, not just him, okay. but there's a group.
So there's a special, you don't just move up to a higher court, you can stay within that same court and get an appeal.
It's a different branch. So you have like your okay. trial and there's an appeals court. There's okay. a whole branch that's just like, that's what they do, is just write appeals. I think from that, after the appeals court, then it's like the Supreme Court, but I'm not completely sure. But where he worked until he was 85 or something, probably a little too long, but he was the Chief Justice of American Samoa for a few years. And so he and my grandmother packed up and moved to American Samoa. And
where is that?
American Samoa is in the South Pacific, probably 5 hours west of Hawaii. We keep going. And it's this tiny little American territory. And there's a governor and then there's the chief justice. So he was the number two guy on the island, which he loved. And he wore they call them lava lavas, and they're like sarongs. And he was all native and just thought it was the greatest thing ever. And my grandmother had sort of emphysema, and so the humidity there was tough for her, and so they ended up coming back because her health was better, drier climate.
Oh, was he very sad?
I think he was very sad, yeah, because who doesn't like being, you know, he was sort of the big mucky muck guy there.
Absolutely. So, I can't imagine coming back from being yeah. the king of an island
yes.
coming back to being just somebody in a traffic jam. So how long was he in Samoa?
I think they were there for probably 3 or 4 years, long enough to get settled, but not so long that when they came back, the house was still there. And
they came yeah. back to Newport?
Yeah. And then he wrote a column for the Daily Pilot about his adventures and stories from his early days, because he had come to Newport when he was like 7 years old. I think it was like 1918. And so obviously he'd seen a lot of changes and some of the stuff that you could get away with, and there's prohibition and the rum running and all that kind of stuff that was happening on Balboa specifically back then. And so he wrote these weekly columns people enjoyed.
Was he still doing judge stuff?
He was. He pretty much always worked. When he wasn't sitting on the bench anymore, he started doing the, it's called JAM, so it's like the
yes.
rent-a-judge, you know, the mediation.
No, actually, I have a good friend who does it. And actually, I do a thing with her every election season. She goes through all the prospective
oh.
candidates.
Yeah, so he did yeah. that until finally age caught up with him and he stepped down.
How did he deal with the rum running? And he was a judge as well as a journalist.
He was young. He was very young when that was all going on. He was a kid. But he was sort of notorious because his group, you know, back then they were a pretty hard drinking crowd, and so he was definitely part of that.
Was he a college student at the time?
No, I think when the whole like prohibition, he was in high school. He was pretty young when all that was going down. He went to USC. That's where he went to law school too. And so once he became a judge, even though he had this somewhat, I wouldn't say rebellious side, but he was very iconoclastic, I guess. We had a friend, my mom would tell the story, a very wealthy friend who gave my grandmother a fur coat for Christmas, and he made her return it because he didn't want there to be any possible idea that he could be accepting a bribe or anything like that. I don't think she ever forgave him for that, that he was being ridiculous.
So I had a situation like that actually at Christmas. The production company that I worked with all year long gave me kind of an extravagant gift. It was a really good camera. And I reported it to head of TV to just tell them and make sure it was all right. And he said, no, you've got to return it. And I realized afterwards, the little gifts that I'd given to all of them actually amounted to more money than that camera that they'd given me. But you've got to do it in a way. It's terrible because it's so nice to get a good gift and you deserve it too. So I totally understand that.
You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Living This Cakes 935. And my guest tonight is Samantha Washer, whom you might know from her byline in Stew News. She's a local at this point. Well, she was always local enough.
Both my parents were born and raised in Newport. My mom and dad met in high school, Newport Harbor High School. My dad got a job as a stockbroker, and we moved to New Jersey. His job was in the city. And so we did that for a few years, and then my parents got divorced. And so my mom and I came back. She, as a single parent, could not afford to live in Newport, even back then. It was still more expensive than Irvine. Well, when it was more reasonable. And so we moved to Irvine. The master plan community is kind of well suited for a kid who has to get herself where she needs to go on a bike.
You mean what we call an estate in England, a housing estate?
Yeah, it's just, there's bike paths and it's sort of this sort of orderly, everything's kind of set up. Unlike Laguna, where the charm of it, Irvine doesn't really have any charm. It's very utilitarian. It's very well thought out and well planned, but there's no charm to it. But if you're a kid trying to get from A to B in Laguna, it can be tricky. The highway is dangerous. The streets are narrow. Irvine, the streets are very wide. There's lots of bike paths.
Maybe that's why kids love it, because I used to rent and my landlords who owned the house actually lived in Irvine and were desperate to be here. Mm-hmm. But their kids wanted to stay in Irvine. And I thought, what kid wants to stay in Irvine when you have Laguna and the ocean? But I guess that's why they can get to each other's homes. They can cycle and it's easy.
It was definitely easy. But my mom, she's not she definitely had to bite the bullet for that because she's very much not a master plan community kind of person. Living in a house that's, every third house is your house and you can only paint it 3 different colors of beige. That's not her.
So, me either. That would drive me crazy.
So she had to be practical and do what she needed to do. But the minute I got my driver's license, we moved to Corona Del Mar.
Well, good for her that she did that. Do you ever feel that she was resentful to her?
No, I think she was kind of relieved. She had to juggle a lot of things, but when she didn't have to juggle many things, then she did what she wanted to do.
See, my mother blamed me for her varicose veins. She said, I got them when I was pregnant with you. I would never have had the end of it if my mother had to make huge sacrifices.
I don't think she ever blamed me for those sacrifices. She did, she carried it very well.
She was mayor of Newport?
She was. She was on the city council in Newport Beach. You term out after 2 terms. So in one of her terms, they appointed her mayor. And so she grudgingly served as mayor. And it was grudgingly because she was saying, when you're mayor, you have to go to all these events. It's sort of more of a social role, and that's not really her cup of tea. But she did it.
Yeah.
And I think she liked it, and I think she was very happy when it was over.
So you can get appointed unwittingly?
Well, I think you have to agree to it, but your fellow council members appoint a mayor, and I think they do the same in Laguna.
Oh, really? But it has to be of their volition, I would think, no?
Yeah, I don't think they can force you to be mayor if you don't want to be mayor, but she agreed to it. She did it for the 8 years.
If you're not social at all, that must be really hard to be a mayor. Would think a mayor is like a what we call hail fellow well met.
Yes, so she... She's gotten better in her older age, but her first choice is not to, go to a banquet and have to give a speech, but she knew the job was, so she did it.
Well, speeches, they say giving speeches, that's people's number one terror.
I would definitely say she's not terrified of that. In fact, probably giving the speeches is for her the best part. It's the social chit-chat that comes before and after, that if she could just come, speak, and leave, that would be fine for her.
Not for me. How about you, listener? Quick reminder here that you're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, along with my guest tonight, local Lagoonan Samantha Washer, on Laguna's KX935, Winging It, which is the topic of my show tonight. We're probably not all as brave as Samantha Walsh's mother when it comes to giving speeches, or as this guy, Ben Burke, whom I'm going to have you listen to for a minute here. He walks onto the stage at TED with a mechanical wooden doll, plonks it in front of his audience, and really does wing it.
This is Edward. Edward's going to help me tell a story. So, yeah, winging it. I kind of live for winging it. Something that didn't really kind of hit me just the other day. It's happening right now, which is exciting. Flying by the seat of your pants. I realized I live for those moments. Though I've also prepared for today. So, you know, Tom. But I'm a showman of various kinds. I do all kinds of shows in all kinds of places. I'm always trying to find a way to make the unexpected happen in a show. And I kind of came about that through working with trash, which is my other great love, something I do on my own, kind of a meditative thing. These are some of my orphans made of orphans from my home for creepy things. Everybody needs a place in this world. I also have a puppet troupe, but all through working with what I've got. I always need something to start with. So I like problems, and I like solving them, and I like, you know, making just even a little bit of magic happen with something. And I like to show how that got to happen. Even when I'm doing shows, it's always like putting on the show is part of the show. So working with what you got, trash, is also a way that I co-founded a theater company, Stars and Garters Theater Company. Me and my friend Jenny Jo Kristen were just writing a show. Started very simple. We had 12 poems about the constellations. And no auditions, we just had friends would come up and say, you know, hey, you guys are writing a show? I want to be in it. Okay. And then someone would say, but I'm not a performer, I don't act, you know, and we'd say, well, all right. We always got this sexy librarian thing going on, and we'll just write in a sexy librarian character. That's perfect. You'll be the ship librarian. That's hilarious. Oh, you could be the narrator. That's perfect, you know. And then someone else would come up and say, you know, I've got a lot of bands, and I really want to be in your show, but I don't have time to memorize lines, man. So he'd say, okay, that's fine, you're mute. Yeah. But we'll make you speak through your instruments and you'll do live sound effects on stage. Yeah, next question. So what we ended up with was a show that was really weird and fun. It was so much fun to do. It was the favorite show of mine. I've done a couple hundred of all different kinds. But people loved it. People would come back and see it two or three times, this silly, ridiculous, song-filled, fun show. So it was great. Things really changed for me, though, when I did the Swimming Cities project. Me and 30 other artists from all over the country put together rafts, made rafts out of trash, and we motored them down the Hudson River into New York City and did shows along the way. I got to play another ship captain. I keep playing ship captains. I don't know why. Now I love ships. And then we took them apart. We shipped them to Slovenia, put them back together, went across the Adriatic Sea, and went into Venice. And we did a show there that I directed. And this changed everything for me because the theater was gone. It was just the show. Just the show kept going on and on, like it is right now. Point being, boats are a great place to know how to get done what you need to get done with only what you've got, which is kind of a credo that I live by. And the point that I just want to make is that we spend a lot of time trying to get things that we think that we want. And a lot of times we don't really know what we want. We get it and it turns out it's not what we wanted. And what I've found is that working in this way gets me something that I love. And at least it makes for a better story, which really is all you have in the end. Isn't that right, Edward? What? That's so unexpected.
Well, I'll leave that last speaker, Ben Burke, behind after his demonstration of the toy he started his talk with that he'd made out of trash didn't work. And I'll spare you the poem he'd written and sung instead for the finale of this TED speech he gave, which didn't really work either. But the point was, he was doing it. He was winging it, but he showed up and did something. Winging It is the topic of my Share an Hour tonight. That's on KX935's The Share an Hour with me, Sharon James. And my guest tonight, local Lagoonan Samantha Washer, who was rather loath to do this interview because she hates the sound of her own voice. I think that applies to a lot of us. But she did it because she is a winging it kind of person. She shows up and is game for a new experience. And that's an asset, really, taking yourself out of your comfort zone, because you find out things about yourself that way and you grow. Samantha and I both deal in narratives. She with her column for Stu News. I with this, The Sharon Hour, for KX935. But we both consider ourselves quasi-journalists because we neither of us do the gritty and interrogative stuff. And that's really intentional on both our parts. I was reading an article in the New York Times today about a journalist, Jose Del Rio, Real being a good name for him because honesty is what he considers his work to be all about. And that's one aspect that even we quasi-journalists can aspire to too. But Del Rio deals in all the stressful stuff that Samantha and I each independently assiduously avoid. The life-altering stuff that's going on in the here and now. He says he's spoken to people minutes after they've seen their friends killed or hours after their homes have burnt down. And he says journalists, real journalists, don't talk enough about how stressful that can be on not just the mind but the body too. Torn away from home on some gruesome assignment. He says he tries to start each of his days when he's on the road by having a 5-minute solitary dance party. Dances by himself for 5 minutes to alleviate stress. He's someone who didn't actually wing it. He worked very hard to get to the position he's in now. He grew up in a trailer park. His parents didn't speak English. They picked fruit when he was a baby. Then his dad fixed cars and washed dishes at restaurants while his mum cleaned hotel rooms, something he did too when he was at high school. He said, but that feels like a lifetime away now. He ended up going to Harvard on a scholarship. He now works at the New York Times. He's married to a university professor, and he's dedicated his life for searching for truth. He says he feels a responsibility to reflect a range of voices and communities in the articles he writes, and to reflect the world as it is, acknowledging our blind spots. And on a vastly smaller scale and in a much tamer way, I think Samantha Washer and I both try to do the same.
So what was the business that you started with your friend?
Oh, it's a copywriting business. So people who need things written for their business. She has stuff that she's done professionally and I have stuff that I've done, but we don't have anything we've done together. So now we're doing free work for people because we need to build stuff that we've done together. And plus we haven't figured out what to charge. So we're just kind of, we're worried about that part later. But now we're working on the Beckman Lasers Institute newsletter.
I guess you could charge by the page, right?
I don't know. She has experience in this area. So.
I wouldn't do it for free. I would just charge a basic and say you're one of our first clients, so we'll do it for almost nothing. Well, she says, doing her radio show for right. 6 years for free.
Yeah, so and plus for nonprofits, happy to do it. Plus I worked for School Power for so long as a volunteer. I did it for 8 years maybe.
Tell me about that. What does that involve?
So School Power is Laguna Beach's education foundation. It's an organization that raises money and then works with the school district on how to spend the money that is raised. It's run by a group of volunteers, trustees, and then we have an executive director and then two other office positions that are paid, but for the most part it's run by volunteers and they put on events throughout the year to raise money.
Like what kind of things? Dance? Or
they have a big dinner dance.
For adults.
Yeah. And the group doesn't run any programs. All School Power does is raise money. And then they give to the schools so the schools can spend it. School Power has to sort of approve how they spend it. Sort of a balancing, they work together. The school district has their needs. School Power raises the money and says, okay, we'll fund of all your needs. We'll put our money towards.
What are the things that you've funded that you're proudest of?
There's a lot of, most recently there's a program called Fund a Need. And at this dinner dance, they pick a specific program. Every year it's been very impactful. So for a couple years, it was all technology-based, trying to bring the classrooms up to the more modern 21st century learning. Then they had furniture for the classrooms, which sounds sort of boring, but when you consider that the classrooms were all set up how they set up when you were in school and I was in school, but the way kids learn now is very different. And so it was really great to be able to fund furniture that moves and is dynamic and it's collaborative. And, all the teachers have screens in their TV and so the kids can turn. And it actually has really impacted how the kids learn, which when I first heard that idea was sort of like furniture. Can't do better than furniture.
So it's all geared towards computers at this point.
Yeah, obviously the teacher still teach, but right. a big component of the educational process now is teaching kids to work collaboratively. So the fact that you can take a desk and bring it together so you can work with a group, and then obviously you're not taking a test as a group, so you can go back and have your own little spot again and then bring it back together. So it is to incorporate the technology, but also just to work collaboratively in the classroom. More dynamic way of teaching.
Educationally, are there any innovations that you've funded? One of my close friends is Ken Robinson. I don't know if you know him, mm-hmm. but that's his topic, is education. He talks about the fact that education is still mired in the industrial age and mm-hmm. it needs to be brought up to a new computer age. I mean, everything is so different now.
Yes.
The education needs to move with it and needs to be more creative, it needs to focus on the creative arts mm-hmm. also more. Do you fund programs?
Yes, so VAR gives money to, they give $300,000 a year just to the school for things like, you know, class size reduction, the performing arts. They've always helped fund the performing arts at the middle school and at the high school. And the music, we did a whole thing with endowment-funded musical instruments for everyone.
Fantastic.
So if anyone wanted to play an instrument, you were given an instrument for free.
Any instrument that you wanted?
I'm not sure, any instrument, but flutes, clarinets, trumpets,
violins.
Yeah, there's your kind of standard orchestra. There is a piano, but they didn't have one for you to take.
No, can you take over? But you can do keyboards these days too.
Yeah, I don't know if they had keyboards. More like band and orchestra type instruments. So they've done a lot of really great things, and the only way they can do that is if the parents and the community members donate, which they do, because the one nice thing about having a small town, you know, there's one high school. And even if you don't have kids, if you live in this town, having a high school that is a well-regarded high school is a, you know, point of pride, and people want to support it.
Totally. No, even if you don't have kids, your property taxes pay
right.
school taxes.
Right.
So, I don't object to that. But is there enough money within school taxes? Because property taxes are high enough that there should be, without having to go to huge fundraising efforts.
We do get our money from property taxes, and so we're not so reliant on the state budget and, you know, how it goes, which
it's allocated.
You know, there's right now the school district is in very good financial shape, but everyone knows about expenses of pensions and things like that are kind of outpacing a lot of just the needs. And so the nice thing about School Power is it's kind of like a value added. It's mm-hmm. not like we're funding to keep the lights on, but like they funded a program for helping kids from a social, emotional wellness area because they're concerned about the suicides that, you know, these kids are dealing with and the stress and everything. And so that was something that the school didn't really have.
Right.
The counselors they have are really overwhelmed with just dealing with the kids and their schedules and the college classes and things like that. They're not necessarily have time in their day to deal with kids who are emotionally in crisis. So they brought in a whole program to address that. Without School Power, they probably would have done it. It would have just taken longer for them to get it up and running. School Power does things that the school district, for the most part, wouldn't do without it. They just tend to make it happen faster.
And probably at a larger scale,
yeah.
right? Have you found, and maybe this is not something you would necessarily know in the position that you were, that kids are more anxious in this day and age?
I mean, just my own kids. Yeah, definitely.
Is it the internet? Is it the peer pressure?
I think it's everything. I mean, I know one of my sons lamented social media. I mean, he recognizes that it's not necessarily a good addition to his life, but they're so connected to it. I mean, for us, I can take it or leave it. I mm-hmm. generally leave it. But I think for the kids, it's such a part of their social life that to just, hey, if it's not making you feel good, stop doing
you
it.
You can't really opt out.
It's almost unfathomable.
But what is astonishing to me, too, because I don't have kids, but I do have young friends, they seem to know this is an aberration, that this mm-hmm. isn't quite right. And I don't know how they know that, really, because they haven't had any experience of anything else. How do they know that this isn't quite the way we're supposed to interact?
I don't know how they know that, except that it must just not feel right in some ways.
Isn't that weird, yeah. though? Why? You've got a 14-year-old, right? She grew up with it all. She didn't know any different.
And I can see the difference between her. There's a 5-year difference between her and her brothers.
How old are they?
They'll be 20 in May.
I guess the internet was just starting in the mid-90s, right? When they
yeah,
were born.
So they weren't quite as... I mean, she's been connected her whole entire
since
life.
A baby.
They didn't get like a smartphone until they were in high school. So that was a little bit of a difference. She had hers when she got into middle school.
But she always had the internet. I mean, she always had that contact with it.
And so she doesn't seem to, I don't know, she seems to handle it better. I mean, she's very kind of savvy about, oh yeah, you know, we do, because they have these kind of ritualistic things that they do where I'm like,
like what?
I know, like they all have to post a picture of themselves. Then all the friends have to comment about how great the person is. And if you don't comment, then that person will call you out on it. And it's not, there's nothing sort of authentic about it. It's just, okay, I'm feeling a little like I need a little love. So I'm going to post a selfie. And then everyone that I know has to say how gorgeous I am. And then...
It's crazy because, I mean, it's not validating either because everyone knows that they've got to do
right.
it.
Right, so it's like this role-playing that, or at least from my experience, just, I'm sure every kid's different, but my daughter is very conscious of sort of this is what happens and this is what you do, and it seems somewhat meaningless in a way, whereas her brothers feel like they take it a little more to heart. Like, even though they know, they'll say, oh, everyone's doing these amazing things. And when I ask them, like, who do you know that's doing amazing things? When they really think about it, pressed to give me a name of a friend of theirs that's doing amazing things, you know, maybe they have one friend who's doing amazing things and the rest of them are just doing what they're doing, which is normal to do when you're in college.
So it breeds this comparative mentality, everything, you're comparing yourself all the time with everybody else.
And even if you're conscious that it's, that people are not, what they're posting is not the truth. I mean, I think there's not a kid in America who doesn't understand that what they're looking at isn't some kind of staged reality, but it's still... Like,
they have to conform with it. Is there any room for a non-conformist? Is there any room for somebody to say, no, you don't look that great today? Or me being me, I'd probably say, oh, I preferred your old hairstyle or something.
Some people find, I mean, that's why we have, people can be very honest, you know.
But not brutal. I mean, that's the other thing. People, when they are honest, seem to be brutal. They seem to kind of go way too far the other way.
And,
you know, it doesn't really help anybody. But it's just to always have comments saying you're wonderful. I mean, this is also what we Europeans think is a bit wrong about American parenting, you know, that the children are told everything is fantastic when they really should get a balance on what is and what isn't for when they're older and they're going to go out in the world and be adults and realize that, no, it was never fantastic.
Right.
You know, you're now competing with people that really do have superior skills.
Yeah, well, I think the parenting model has shifted back a little more. I mean, it did sort of go, you know, everybody gets a trophy mentality and now it's, I mean, I think the problems with that have come to roost, and so now, you know, pendulum always swings back.
So it is going, do you think that's a reaction to this internet stuff where the peers are actually performing in that capacity?
Yeah, I just think now, even for so long, like when my boys were young, it was all about self-esteem, you know, making your kids feel good about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And now it seems like they've moved away from that. Now it's all about grit and trying to teach your kids how to stick with it. Because when you tell everyone you're great and everything they do is great,
they don't understand when they go out into the world and somebody says, no, you're not great.
Yeah, when all of a sudden it's not great and they're not the best.
Right.
And you can't. Then they can't function. So now it's like, okay, well, now we've got to teach these kids that they got to really dig down deep and persevere in the face of adversity. So somewhere, and you know, if we just sort of stayed in the middle course, we wouldn't have to be constantly flipping back.
I know.
The
middle is always best, isn't it? More and more, I think I like mediocrity. I like it in the people that I know.
Well, then we'll be good friends.
You're listening to The Sharer now on Lagunas KX935. I'm Sharon James, talking tonight to local Lagunan Samantha Washer about life stuff and how we deal with it.
Did you find you brought up your sons and daughters differently, or did you find they kind of came out of the womb differently?
I mean, having twins is a definite nurture versus nature.
Are they different?
It's very different.
In what ways? Without breaking their personal space?
Yeah, they're just are very different. One is very adventurous. One is very methodical. They're very different, and they've always been very different.
I wanted to do a show on twins, actually. Would they do it?
Yeah, maybe. You'd have to do it when they were both home, which these days is hard to do, but...
Are they attached to each other, or do they pull out each other's differences all the time?
Brutal to each other. Very competitive with each other. They were never the twins that couldn't be without the other. I'm an only child, so I didn't have siblings, so having twins was not that experience. So I just tried to raise them as, have them be two individuals that happened to be twins. I didn't really focus on the twin thing that much, I don't think. Tried not to, I guess. I mean, now that they're in separate schools, I think they've gotten a lot closer or appreciate each other more, that they are not constantly next to one another. And
are they fraternal? Are they identical twins?
Well, that's a good question. So it should be an easy... I think they're fraternal. They look identical. Even to this day, people can't tell them apart. I mean, now that they're getting older, I should say, people are finding it easier to tell them apart, but they still look very much alike and have always looked alike. So we kept saying we're going to get them tested, get a DNA test just to have a confirmation, because the doctors had said if they're fraternal, they should have sort of deviated a little bit more. They never really deviated. They had the same height, same weight.
Oh, really? Yeah,
kind of all the way.
Which, I forget, is that the split egg fraternal?
Two separate eggs.
Fraternal is two separate?
Yeah.
And which is the split egg?
Identical.
But they're both?
Well, there's a third option, apparently, but okay. It's very rare.
And that is?
I don't know what it's called. I just read about it not that long ago, known in Australia, I think.
No, it's funny, because there's always a third. There's a third sex, you know, right. I mean, people are born into sex, right. And it's very common, actually, and yet doctors sort of take it away at the beginning. In fact, my show called Gender Benders is about that.
Which, of course, you can always listen to on podcast at kx935.com. But here's the deal with twins, fraternal versus identical. Fraternal twins are what's called dizygotic, which means that they develop from two different eggs fertilized by two different sperm cells. And identical twins are monozygotic, which means they developed from one single fertilized egg that's split. The third type of twins that my guest Samantha Washer was talking about were identified in Australia are called sesquizygotic. And they figured that the mother's egg was fertilized simultaneously by two of the father's sperm and then divided to create semi-identical twins. You'd think that that would mean they'd have more of the father's DNA, but they only have a little bit of the father's DNA, and they appear to have 100% of their mother's. However, this type of twin is extremely rare, whereas approximately 3 in 1,000 children born are identical twins, and that is the same all around the world, while between 6 and 20 per 1,000 twins are fraternal, and there's a big variety depending on where you live in the world. In Nigeria, the rate goes up to about 45 per 1,000, and in Western Africa in general, the incidences of fraternal twins being born is higher than the rest of the world. I'm not sure why. Speculation has it that it's something to do with the amount of yams consumed, but I'll look into that more when I do my show on twins. You're tuned to The Sharer Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. And my guest tonight is local Lagunan Samantha Washer, writer and Stu News contributor, as well as mother of twins.
Do they have, like, instincts about each other?
I mean, I don't think they have. I've never heard them express, you know, you hear about twins having pain when their, you know, sibling has pain. I don't think that they have that. I just think they know each other very well. They know each other in a way that I, as a parent, couldn't know them. And I don't know if it's different as siblings in general know each other differently than our parents. They know each other better than they know their sister. And I don't know if it's because they're twins or because they spent every day together doing basically the same thing because they're in the same grade and they have the same friends.
Oh, because they're male and we're female.
Yeah. I don't know exactly what the root of it is, but for sure they know each other very well, warts and all.
How do you know that? Do they talk to you about it?
No, just the way they speak about each other.
And do they surprise you with what they know about each other?
Well, they don't disclose anything about one another that they wouldn't want.
And men don't disclose anyway, do they?
Yeah. I mean, it's not like they tell me things about the other that I'm like, oh, they're pretty tight-lipped about it. It's just, I don't know, just an interaction. I don't think anyone can make them as mad as each other, which I think is like a certain kind of intimacy or something.
Yeah,
can
totally.
You.
That's why I wanted to do a show on it, because it must be very weird having somebody walking around that looks exactly like you or very, very much like you.
Yeah, and always being confused as that person. It would be as a person who, like I said, with no siblings. I mean, I was always me. There was nobody else. And their friends would be, their name's Zach and Judge. Are you, hey, Judge. Oh, I'm Zach. Okay, whatever. It didn't matter. It was just like, whatever one you are, this is the one we... I mean, they weren't trying to be inconsiderate, but if you were that person, I am different than that person.
Like, you either
interchangeable.
Have your identity wrongly analyzed or you're assumed by the other person's identity. Must be very weird.
Yeah.
And the girl, is she very different from boys?
Completely.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because you do wonder about that. You know, Ken Robinson, my friend, talks about that how children are so different to each other that you can't just say it's DNA and that they assume parents' identity, or even that it's nurture. It's something endemic, I suppose, that you just kind of are born with your own personality.
Yeah, I feel like now having kids, and now that they're sort of moving away from being little kids, that I think as parents you can certainly affect your children, especially if you're abusive. I mean, negatively, I think it's quite easy to impact your kids negatively.
Yes.
But I think it's just little varying degrees, and that's why I always joke that I can't take credit, nor will I take responsibility.
I mean, do you think you learnt anything from your parents? Do you learn your ethical outlook on life from your parents? I don't feel that I did learn very much from them. I mean, I did learn a negativity. I did learn about being overcritical, mm-hmm. and I carried that over.
Mm-hmm.
Just reading this book that talks about how just as you learn your mother tongue, you learn a negative language or a positive language. You learn the language of failure or the language of success. And that's something most likely comes, well, not necessarily from your parents, can come from your teachers or your peers. Mm-hmm. And that's a language you talk to yourself in, and you have to sort of learn a different language if you want to get out of that self-critical thing. You have to learn to speak to yourself in a different language, a more positive, encouraging language, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
Did you feel that you learned anything from your parents?
I do, but I think only child, single mom, we were kind of just the two of us. She remarried, but before she did that, it was just kind of the two of us. And so I think I probably got more from her than a more typical family.
Yeah.
You know?
You totally had all her attention and time.
And so for better and for worse, there was no buffer or filter. It was just her to me.
And did you remain close because of it?
Yeah, we're still very close.
You're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX 935. My guest tonight is the lovely Samantha Washer, who writes about people for Stu News. But a couple of weeks ago, Stu News turned the tables on her and wrote about her. And they mentioned that one of her favorite movies was Brazil. So I wanted to know if it was a film or if she was a particular fan of the British director of the film, Terry Gilliam.
Well, I just was listening to a radio interview with Terry Gilliam, and I'm not sure that I would like him personally necessarily. I'm sort of the easygoing, the easiest path to take personality, and he is so not like that. And I guess when I was younger, that spoke to me because I admired that. Like, I'm going 30 years to make the latest movie. I mean, not many people would care anymore. You just would give up and say, okay, whatever. How do you want, studio? How do you want me to make it? I'll make it like that. And he just isn't wired that way. I totally respect that.
Yes. No, I'm sort of like you. I fell into a lot of things, but it does mean I've had a varied professional life because of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. And I think I was ambitious when I was young, just to be with the most interesting people I can find in the world, and still am pretty much that. That was my ambition. I didn't have to be the top of them. I just had to be accepted in their midst, or be allowed to meander through their midst somehow. And I think that's still my ultimate ambition.
I think that's a good ambition.
And I do envy people that are goal-oriented. I don't think I could ever define an actual goal for myself. You?
No. I keep thinking, like, I started meditating, and one, it was a guided meditation. It was just an app on my phone, and it was like, picture what happiness, all these, like very
a vision
specific,
board kind of an
very
idea.
Specific things, and I was like, some reason, I'm just totally not wired that way. It's more like I can picture a feeling of how that feels, but there's no specific, like, I couldn't say, well, if I just got to point B, then it's all there. I've just sort of gone along and tried to enjoy the
I do notice, though, maybe because I'm sort of conscious now, I do make myself notice when I'm suddenly excited about something, when something actually just does really thrill me, or when I feel it's what Ken calls being in the flow of something, where it's just moving along, the hours go past, and you're just completely absorbed in whatever it is, and I kind of try to pinpoint what that is. I mean, writing to some extent, but it's also a horror. It's miserable when you feel compelled to complete something. Do you get that with writing or not?
Well, I'm very good. I'm a good deadline person. So you were to give me an assignment and say, I need you to do this, I would get it done. I could never be the people who come home from their job and would write for 4 hours a night, every night. if nobody's waiting for the end result, I'm very quick to go, yep, this sucks, and I put it away, and I look at it, and I'm like, it's not a masterpiece. I'm smart enough to know what's good, and I've never been able to get past the, like, they just do it for the sake of the enjoyment of it. Because if there's nobody waiting for it at the end, it's very easy for me to just go, yeah, it's not very good, and move on to something else.
Is that with your creative writing?
Yeah.
I'm the same. I mean, I've tried doing, like, forcing myself to sit down for certain hours to certain hours. But then it's sort of the tossing and turning at night, and then you have one sentence that's floating around, and do I wake myself up and write it down? It's torture in a way. And then when you think that you've got something absolutely right and it's just flowed out of you, and you reread it and it's terrible. And it's always when you thought you'd done something wonderful, and then the times that you think it's awful, you find one magical sentence.
Yep. Well, listener, I have to start to wind this show up at this point. You've been listening to the lovely Samantha Washer, a fellow Lagoonan narrative creator, let's say. We neither of us feel entitled to call ourselves real journalists because we don't do the gritty stuff and the in-depth interrogative stuff either. We neither of us have the stomach for it. But listen, you can forge a career by being an amateur at things. Amateur, after all, just means lover of. You don't have to be expert. Even the experts can be stymied by prevailing forces, so winging it career-wise can be a formidable way to live a life. Just as interesting and exciting as being singularly directed and focused on something particular you're especially proficient at. If you want to hear this show again, it does podcast. Go to kx935.com, where you can become a member of this local public radio station, and we'd love that. For this particular show, go to kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, which is what I like to do every week, plus it's a pun on my name. And then it's hour with the H. This is Sharon James, wishing you the best life ever and the best week ahead. Hoping you'll come back for more interviews, discussions, topics on the Sharon Hour every Monday night at 9 p.m. My show tonight was entitled Winging It, and I'll leave you with this message from a bright college student called Avery.
Winging it can apply to many aspects of many jobs. Professors, teachers, business managers, event organizers, musicians, actors, but especially EMTs. Now, you may say, how come this doesn't apply to doctors? Well, doctors do have to adapt to different medical situations, but they have years and years of extensive training. I also am in no way recommending that a brain surgeon just wing it. However, if you don't know, you can actually become an EMT in a mere matter of months. And if you've ever watched them work in high-stress situations where there are lives on the line, they adapt, they stay calm, and they do their job. And they can come upon an incident that they have never seen before, and they're still able to do their job. And this is because they've actually practiced reacting to situations that they've never seen before. The United States military is actually using this, and this is what fascinates me so much. They have a concept they're calling mission command, and the point of it is to create versatile leaders. In the U.S. Army Doctrine Publication 6.0, they actually state that the objective is to concentrate on objectives of an operation, not how to achieve it. It then goes on to say, subordinates then exercise disciplined initiative to respond to unanticipated problems. If we have such a high-profile, globally reaching organization that is well-prepared, actually practicing being unprepared, why aren't we applying this to different aspects of our life? Why aren't we applying this to our business, to our education? Winston Churchill said, to each there comes in their lifetime a special moment where they are figuratively tapped on the shoulder and offered the chance to do something great, unique to them and fitted to their talents. There are certain things you cannot prepare for, and practicing being unprepared is the best way to prepare for them.
So then, listener, perhaps you don't always have to prepare for something specific in life. You just have to be prepared to show up. I'm Sharon James, looking forward to having you with me on KX935's The Sharon Hour next week.